Hi, and welcome back to Activists of Tech, the Responsible Tech Podcast. All of us are familiar with influencers by now. They're all over social media trying to picture a perfect life while selling their followers products through brand deals or online courses of any sorts on how to live their fabricated lifestyle. Idols can do whatever they want with their free time, including posting their personal info and life anecdotes on social media. This is none of my business. However, it becomes problematic when it comes to children. Kids online cannot give informed consent to become part of the family influence industry that is, unlike kids in acting careers, barely, if at all, regulated. To date, only 3 US states have signed this type of protective legislation into law, and many more have built in the work. YouTube family channels, for instance, gather millions of followers, and kids in these videos become the primary source of income for their families. Horror stories of behind-the-scenes abuse have emerged in recent news stories, in addition to the serious need to protect the privacy and the financial exploitation potential of these kid influencers. Joining us today is Chris McCarthy, a junior at the University of Washington majoring in political science. When they were 17, Chris founded Quit Clicking Kids, an advocacy organization to safeguard the rights of children who grew up on monetized family social media accounts. Chris founded Quit Clicking Kids after discovering that child social media stars lacked the same rights and protections as child actors. Since then, they have worked with legislators in Oregon, Washington, Minnesota, and other states to introduce protective legislations, successfully getting legislation introduced in over 20% of state legislators, with 2 states already passing it into law. Chris was bold enough to cold email and cold call Washington legislators, leading to the introduction of House Bill 2032, which aims to protect children featured in revenue-generating family vlogs by addressing their privacy and property rights. Chris has secured similar laws in 2 states and has been featured by the New York Times, the Associated Press, and more. They have spoken at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, and were featured in the Demi Lovato-directed documentary called Child Star, and recently made the Forbes list of 30 under 30 in the social media category. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what's your story?
Well, my name is Chris McCarthy, and I'm the student founder and executive director of Quit Clicking Kids, which is an advocacy organization designed around education and impact to help protect the child stars and child performers of monetized family social media accounts.
I think you founded Quit Clicking Kids when you were 17 or fairly young. How did you end up getting the idea, and what are you currently working on? Do you have any specific projects?
I did found Quit Clicking Kids when I was 17, and the reason for that founding was because I read a story about a family influencer who is now sort of infamous among the Family Influencers League for adopting a special needs child from outside of the country and then making a series of monetized content about that child that included some pretty intimate information about how he was adjusting to their family. And it seemed a little bit invasive privacy-wise in terms of one of the things that she did with that child was have her followers donate money to unlock a jigsaw puzzle of his face before he was even officially adopted. So you have a child whose image and name was shared very publicly and then monetized. And then following a few years, that parent decided to relinquish custody of the child without telling anybody. So that led to, understandably, a pretty significant backlash when people were saying, you used to have another kid, what happened, where is he? And that led to what I would call the sort of stereotypical YouTuber apology video, where they said that the reason they hadn't made that decision public is because they wanted to respect that child's privacy. So that disconnect between all that they had shared about him previously, not only the frequency and consistency of their sharing, but also the depth of the information that was shared, and then suddenly saying that they cared about his privacy, that disconnect really prompted me to do more research into, okay, what does it mean to be a family influencer, and what does it mean that this is becoming a new industry?
Yeah, this sounds incredibly problematic, actually. Could you give us a broad overview of this family influencing industry in the United States? What does it look like on social media? And also give us some numbers. I feel like, at least on my YouTube page recommendations, I have so many family channels that have been emerging in the past few years. So, like, what does it look like?
That's a great question, and that's actually something that's really hard to pin down. I can give you some of the numbers that I find most interesting, but because of the opaqueness of the algorithms that are both promoting and sort of deciding the monetization thresholds for these content pieces, it is very difficult to for some of these things to be quantified. What I can say is that family influencing accounts are some of the most popular genres out there. And there was recently a Fast Company article that came out that says there are more than 500 hours of videos uploaded to YouTube every minute. And of course, platforms that offer short form content like TikTok and Instagram Reels have millions of active users per day. So we do see a lot of really heavy engagement with these family influencing accounts. It isn't just a side gig or a hobby. And to further expand on that point, there was an article from Credit Karma that came out that said accounts with 1 million subscribers who post weekly content can make upwards of $900,000 a year. So that's even on the low end for the 1 million subscribers, but you can tell from that number alone, this is an industry. This isn't just a side gig or a hobby or something that these families are doing for fun. A lot of them are doing it as a business, as their primary source of income, and in some cases, even their sole source of income.
What kind of risks are kid influencers facing? Because as you just stated, it's an industry, so they're basically working, but they're not necessarily protected by the law. And I would love to hear more about the parasocial relationships they enter without consenting. It's the parents making this decision and how it impacts them.
Definitely, there are so many risks. Just as a, I think as a broad overview, and then we can dig into the parasocial aspect. So you do have those parasocial relationships that can kind of become a threat. You have threats of identity theft, given all the information that is shared online, like birthdays, n full names, images, location sensitive information. That always potentially can lend itself to be a problem. You also have the threat of financial exploitation for these children. But delving into the parasocial relationship platform as part of the research for this piece that I've been doing, I did go through and sort of like pull comments from one of the more popular family Instagram accounts just posts. And so one of the things that I find really interesting was one of those comments was, "It's been 4 months since you've posted anything. You're leaving all your fans hanging." So the idea of being a fan of an actual real life family, right? Not characters in a television show or in a movie, but being a fan of somebody's real life and the content that they're posting about themselves, that really struck me as a potential concern, especially again when you have children being the primary focus of that. And building off on that, you have people saying like, "These kids are my reason for living." Right, so you do see this really, really strong level of attachment between the followers of the channel and then the people who are posting content. And I think for a lot of parents, this doesn't immediately raise red flags because they are this perceived safety and this perceived artificial distance. I'm like, well, I'm posting it and then people online can comment on it, but they don't really, like, really have access to my kids, right? Like they're very removed from that side of the equation. But another one of the comments on the channel was, "I saw you at the mall today and you looked so beautiful," right? So clearly there are people who do have access to these families and to these children. They do live close by. And something that I would really encourage parents to keep in mind is that that artificial distance is just that. It's artificial. Realistically, you don't know where these people are commenting from. You don't know what access they may or may not have to your family.
Yeah, and if I may add, I feel like when people post a picture of their kid just playing soccer, you have the name of the team on their shirt. It's one Google search away.
Yeah, I think there's something that we need to be concerned about in terms of the increasingly digital age that we're entering right now. If you look at where AI is trending, where deep fakes are trending, where reverse image searching is trending, it's become increasingly easy to find out somebody's whole life story essentially just from their name or from a photo of them. So it is really, really crucial that parents are keeping in mind what types of things they're sharing about their children online. Especially, you have so many of these families who are talking about their children's grades and their mental health issues and their physical health issues. You have parents who are like posting videos of their kids' ER visits, right? So it's just so important to remember that that information can always be used by somebody with malintent if you're sharing it on a public platform. And even for the parents who are trying to be safe, we are entering a world of like increasingly digitally altered images and where those are looking more and more real. So just generally, it's important to make sure that if you are sharing your kids online, you're doing so in the safest way possible, whatever that looks like, whether that's blurring their faces or maybe like just obscuring part of the image, whatever that looks like. Just trying to make sure that you're protecting their privacy and their dignity.
You participated in the documentary called Child Star as one of the experts interviewed by Demi Lovato, who is a former child star on Disney Channel herself. What got my attention is that there were a lot of laws stated in the US that are in place specifically to protect children on movie sets, like just kids actors in the creative and film industry. But there are no, basically, not as many equivalents for kids influencers, and they're not even consenting to just being influencers, I believe, when you're 4 or 5, like you don't even know what Instagram really means. What does the policy landscape look like in terms of protecting kids, actors, and in comparison, what legal guardrails are currently in place to protect kids and influencers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a very small but growing field, I would say, because we have had laws surrounding traditional child actors for so much longer than the internet has even really existed. But we are seeing more and more states starting to introduce legislation. So, for example, for 2025, Massachusetts, Missouri, New Jersey, New York, Washington State, these are all places who are committed. They have already introduced legislation and they're ready for the next legislative session. So we are seeing a continuing momentum, and I think that's really important to know. And I really hope that that trend can continue because we need to make sure that child performers, whether that's in traditional forms of media or whether that's online influencing, are protected both financially and in terms of their privacy and security. The types of work are very, very similar, but child actors are still playing a part. They're not having their real lives being used for content and for that consumption, that mass consumption. And so while they're both very similar fields, you have children growing up in the public eye, there is that potential for financial exploitation. You do also have that very clear difference of, at least in the eyes of the former child actors that I've had the privilege to speak to, they said that they knew when they could go home at the end of the day and they could just be themselves. And of course, for the child influencers of today's digital age, there isn't that same separation. The lines are very much blurred.
Can you tell us more about the legislation work you've been doing so far, specifically working and co-drafting Bill 1627, I believe, for the Washington State House and the Minnesota HF 34881? What were their focus and what were their impacts?
Yes, absolutely. In Washington State, the bill that I helped to co-create was essentially outlining two major protections for child performers on family social media accounts. The first is financial compensation. So similar to Jackie Coogan laws, which set aside a percentage of the money that the child earns for the child once they reach the age of 18 in a protected trust account. This financial protections of the child influencer safety bills would do the same thing. And that compensation, what that looks like, varies from state to state. But generally, the idea is to make sure that the parents aren't able to financially exploit their child. They aren't able to spend all of their child's earnings or the money that the gross revenue that the channel generates. And then the second part of the bill is, again, allowing that right to privacy. So when children reach the age of 18, once they reach the age of majority, they can request a social media platform to go and delete content that featured of them when they were a child, when they were unable to consent. And Washington State and Minnesota both have those provisions. A couple of the other states that signed the bill into law don't have the privacy protection provision, which I would be happy to talk about more. But it is important to know that both of those provisions can go through. Minnesota is the living proof that we can have both of those protections together in the same bill and really do our best to provide a comprehensive support system for these children.
Can we go back to the parasocial relationships? Actually, you made me think with the support system thing. How does it impact the children?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a lot of parents aren't aware yet. Again, I think because of that artificial distance setup, it's very hard to understand the real world harms that might come out of these parasocial relationships. But I think if you were to contextualize it in a real world scenario, for example, and I'll pull up some of these comments again just for reference, but if you had, let's say, like a next door neighbor who was saying all of these things about your child, like one of the comments under the video about a child who I believe at the time was 4 years old was, "I wish I could be as skinny as her." And so if you had like a next door neighbor who was watching your family and who was saying things like making comments on your child's physical appearance in such an intimate way, and then they were saying things like, "Wow, you know, it's been 4 months since you took your child out to play in the backyard and I can't look at them anymore. I can't see them anymore." I think that that would raise a lot of red flags for us because we could see the real world harm there. We could see that unhealthy investment, and we would be forced to think about it in a very different way if it was somebody who we knew was very close to us and could have access to ourselves and our family. So I think trying to expand that education piece. And again, when I was introduced, like one of the things I wanted to talk about is quick-clicking kids is education, but it's also impact, right? And those two things go hand in hand. Impact is very much the legislative facing aspect. But education really centers around building a social media presence, ironically, because it is a good way to get information out. And it's trying to inform both parents who might consider posting their kids online, and also consumers of this type of content where the potential harms are and how to engage with social media as safely as possible.
And so this is a very interdisciplinary issue. What specialties of law and other disciplines do you think should be involved in regulating the influencer industry? Should former kids influencers be involved? Who should be asked?
Definitely. And I think we really want to get as many people as possible involved in the decision-making process here. Part of the reason for that is because, again, the issue is so new. I think the more perspectives we have, the more well-rounded we can build out our cause, and the stronger we'll be able to make the legislation. We'll be able to make it as protective as it can be. I think the different areas of law that tie into this are family law, business law, technology law. In Washington State, this bill has been referred to the Civil Rights and Judiciary Committee in the past. Like, there are so many different aspects of this, including also, I would argue, privacy law, right? There are all of these different things that kind of get folded under the umbrella of how do we make family influencing safe? How do we make it safe for the kids? How do we make it, how do we make sure that the parents are sort of following be best practices? There's just so many different areas to consider, and it can be very tricky because essentially we don't have anything to draw on because, again, the novelty of the issue is really something that we're all having to grapple with, and we're all trying to figure out the best solution as social media continues to grow and develop. But it is very exciting also. We're having a lot of experimentation. We're doing a lot of research. We're doing a lot of learning. And we're really creating legislation that nobody has ever seen before.
And when you started to be involved, you were in high school, and I'm wondering how has your work been received by policymakers, especially when I'm assuming you reached out at this very young age, and how aware did you find the policy space about the issues surrounding the kids influencer industry on social media?
Yeah, it's kind of been a give and take situation. I think a lot of legislators were actually very excited to have somebody who was so interested and so motivated to work in the policy space at a young age, and they were really excited to sort of help out in that space. I think, and again, I'm a political science major, so take what I say with a grain of salt. I do think a lot of politicians get a bad rap for not caring about youth voices and not caring about modern concerns. And I think to a certain extent that's true. I think that's part of what held us back in Washington State a little bit was the aging legislature, who was maybe not as aware of the very real world harms that can come out of allowing this industry to continue to go unregulated. But I think also, like, the fact that I was able to connect with a Washington state representative during a short legislative session, and then the fact that that issue was picked up by Illinois and now it's been picked up by California and New York and New Jersey and Minnesota and Arizona and all of these other states, I think that speaks very well to a commitment to the future that a lot of legislators have. I think it's important to remember that they're real people with families and that most of them do care about how the next generation is going to end up. And I will say, just to continue the positivity thread, because I think that's something that a lot
I
of
love
people
it.
might need right now.
Yeah.
One of the other things is that the legislation has received overwhelming bipartisan support, and that's something that brings me a lot of joy. The idea that we can still come together over protecting child rights is something that it means so much to me as a youth advocate. But like, of all of the things that are increasingly polarized right now, of all of the things that are kind of like holding us back and moving us backwards, like this is still something that we can work together to champion. That means a lot.
I was about to say at least for now, but I'm gonna keep going on the hope. But yeah, it's very hopeful. It's very positive. Now, a more technical question. Do you think that recommender systems should stop pushing content that include kids on social media?
I have a lot of different thoughts about this. I think in my ideal world, I don't know that child performing would even exist as an industry, but I don't think that's something that's very feasible to regulate. I think there need to be a lot more studies about the ethics of child performers and child actors, both in the traditional sense and in the sense of being a social media star. I don't feel qualified to have like a position one way or the other on this because I think there are too many nuances here. I think in my ideal world, we would be a lot more careful than we are currently about what how we set up boundaries for children to interact with media.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. You talked a lot about privacy, so let's talk about privacy and the issues surrounding putting your child's face online from a very, very young age. At what age do you think a child could be able to consent to create content for their parents to post online or even to have their own social media account?
This is also something that I go back and forth on. And you'll see, even in the different states that have introduced legislation, every state has a slightly different take on it. Some will say like 13 is an appropriate age for a child to have a social media account and to be posting on it. Some say 16. So there's definitely some variation there. I do think that it is a very tricky question, right? And one of the things that I like to think about when it comes to consent is the FRIES acronym. So consent should be freely given, reversible, informed, enthusiastic, and specific. And I think it's very easy to see that in a lot of ways, family accounts don't quite measure up to that. For just even starting with freely given, right? So many of these accounts, the parents are becoming the bosses. That right there is probably one of the biggest conflicts of interest you could have. And so, especially when the children are still young, you know, they're dependent on their parents. That you have this situation where there's a lot of money involved. It's a very sticky situation of like how much does the kid really want to be on the channel versus how much are they expected to be on the channel, especially for these accounts where it is becoming like a primary source of income for the family or even the sole source of income for the family. There are some very, very tough ethical questions I think that come along with that of like, is the child free to consent in that scenario? And in terms of reversible, and this again goes back to privacy, the internet is something that is very, very difficult to reverse. Once something is out there, people can download videos, they can take screenshots of posts. It is very, very hard to get that back. So I think in that way, family social media accounts fall short. And then informed, enthusiastic, and specific all kind of go together. I personally can't imagine trying to explain to an 8-year-old, here is what me posting you on social media would look like. Here are all of the potential concerns that you would have to be worried about in terms of parasocial relationships and identity theft. And then in 5 to 10 years, you may no longer want this content out there, but I might not want to delete it as a parent because it was my post, right? Like all of these different factors kind of tie into it. And that makes it very difficult for the consent to be informed, enthusiastic, and specific.
So, what do you recommend to parents when it comes to social media? Even if their content doesn't fully revolve around their kids, what would you advise them?
I think one of the most important things is to not show your kid's face online and to not use their real name. So, for example, like covering, if you want to post a picture of your kids, but just like covering them with an emoji or something like that, just so that it's harder for people to go through and scrub that data. And then, you can say things like, "Oh, my child did XYZ." But you don't need to put their full name out there. You don't need to make it easier for people to find them, essentially. And especially when they're so young, right? They don't have the choice to create this digital footprint. You're creating it for them. So I think as non-personal as you can make the account, the better. I can understand parents wanting to use social media as a platform to connect with other parents. I can understand them wanting to have that bond or use it as a support system. But I think a lot of those functions, like nobody needs to know your kid's name for that to happen. You can talk about your kid without making it so clear and so personal and so intimate.
Yeah, that is very, very true. Chris, you were so efficient. We are already done with the question set. I do have a lightning round, and I have another question. Because you're very young and very driven, what's next for you? Like, what's your ideal career path? Why are you pursuing political science? Where do you see yourself in 5 years, is my question.
That's a great question. So again, currently I'm a university student, so that's occupying most of my time right now. I would really love to work in the legislature, whether that be at the state level or at the federal level. This is something I'm really passionate about, and I have been for a long time. I, again, self-proclaimed public policy nerd. This is something that I love doing, and it's a lot of work, but I really thoroughly enjoy it. So I do want to work in that advocacy legislative space.
I love that for you, honestly, that you found your path and your passion already.
Thank you.
So, this is my fun question set, supposedly. What do you do to remain hopeful for the future of the rights of kids online?
One of the things I look at is honestly the progress that we've made already, and not even just in terms of the legislation that's being introduced and the things that are ready to go for 2025, but in terms of if you look back to even like before Coogan laws, right, which are a pretty recent addition to the legislative space, like we have made so much progress. And I think one of the things that keeps me hopeful is that things have been so much worse historically. And so the fact that we're able to move forward from that, however slowly, is really promising to me. I think one of my favorite quotes from a book is that humans have very short memories. And that's why our studying of history is so important, because if we don't keep that in mind, we're liable to make the same mistakes. So I think if we look back and we're able to understand where we came from and how, I don't want to say dire because that's a very strong word, but if you look at the sort of the landscapes that we were working in traditionally and historically, we have been able to move so far from that. So that gives me hope for the future that we can continue pushing forward.
What's your favorite thing about tech policy? I think you kinda answered that already, but
Yeah, I can answer that again, certainly. I think my favorite
there is
thing
more things that you love about tech policy. Let's hear it.
I think one of my favorite things about tech policy is just how new it is. Like it's very frustrating because there isn't, a long list of precedents that you can go and look up, but it's also very, very exciting because there's always something new to learn, right? Like whether that's a new platform or a new technology, there's always something fresh that you can delve into, and there's so many different facets of it, whether that's through monetization, whether that's through privacy or freedom of speech. Anything you can think of really can be tied back in some way to tech law, and I really do enjoy that.
What's your song of the moment?
I think the thing that I've been listening to most right now is La Vie en Rose by Louis Armstrong.
Wow, I love this one.
I know, right? It's a lovely song.
Well, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hold me close and hold me fast. The magic spell you cast. This is La Vie en Rose. When you kiss me, heaven sighs, and though I close my eyes, I see La Vie en Rose.